Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right?
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 184, 1982's Conan the Barbarian. Now, some people say the best things in life aren't things. So what are the best things in life?
Well, I thought you were going to say the best things in life aren't free.
Oh, well, there's that too.
But actually, the best things in life are free.
They are.
It's to crush your enemies, to see them driven before you, and most importantly, to hear the lamentations of their women.
Oh boy, those lamentations.
Yes, yeah, I love lamentations. I forgive my pitiful Arnie impersonation, but we're back with our good buddy Arnie for, as you said before, 1982's Conan the Barbarian. And this is early Arnie. This is before he became a massive global superstar. This is when he was still trying to make a name for himself in Hollywood. You know, obviously he was a lauded
bodybuilder
with many Mr. Olympia championships. Yeah, he was trying to segue from bodybuilding to acting. And this is not his first acting role. His first acting role is actually a movie called Hercules in New York, which this is kind of funny. I actually saw it on TV in, of all places, Israel. I was sitting
there. Okay, tell.
I was in Israel. I was 13 years old, and okay. I was taken to the Holy Land of Israel.
Yeah.
And we were there for about 3 weeks, and this is before Airbnb, but we managed to rent an apartment for our 3 week stay. And I was staying in with my grandparents, my sister, my mother. We were staying in this kind of shitty apartment with lots and lots of lizards walking around and scurrying about, and it was a walk up. It was like fifth floor. I was out of shape. I was a fat kid. Very different than Arnie. And there's a TV there. And at that point, really, TV was my life. I mean, that's where I got all my entertainment from. And what sort of television again is real in 1989?
That better be a rhetorical question.
Basically, it was two things that would be broadcast in English. An infinite amount of Happy Days reruns, over and over and over again. I must have seen about 40 episodes of Happy Days while I was in Israel. And the odd movie here and there. And one of these movies was Hercules in New York, starring a young, and it's interesting too, because I believe he was billed as Arnold Strong, playing the titular character Hercules in New York. And they did dub him over for his dialogue in the movie. He didn't have much dialogue, but it was dubbed, because he's got that Teutonic accent, the Austrian accent. So it's just this really, really pitiful movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger plays Hercules, and somehow he's in New York and he's running around. And I just loved it. I mean, when you're in a foreign country and you find something that you can watch in English, you're going to watch it, no matter what. So, I don't know what year that came out. I'm assuming late 70s, early 80s. Then there was, of course, the infamous documentary Pumping Iron, where Arnie compared the pump to having an orgasm. This, of course, before he became a staunch Republican. And, yeah, I think, you know, this, if not his major big screen debut, Conan O'Brien. I think I might leave it in here. Yeah. If not his major big screen debut, Conan the Barbarian was one of the first. He was an unproven commodity at the time. But honestly, who else could have played Conan? Ferrigno was
indisposed. I was going to say Hulk Hogan. It just made me laugh that this is a sidetrack. But
Ferrigno could have done it. He was doing those shitty Hercules movies.
You know, I guess so.
Yeah, by Luigi Cozzi and everything, and you were saying Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, Hulk Hogan. No, it's just an aside.
Hulkamania had yet to run wild.
I was just thinking of the parallels between Hogan and Schwarzenegger, because both of them were touting the virtues of rugged individualism and hard work, and yet both were also not actually working hard, but pumping themselves full of steroids. So Schwarzenegger loves to tell the tale of how America was such a boon to him, and how it was so wonderful, and how he was had it so rough in Austria, and then came here, and then worked hard, and through like his, you know, stick-to-itiveness and nose to the grindstone, he became a big star. And really, while he might have been a gym rat, really what launched him was pills and needles. I mean, this is ridiculous. And, well, I guess the fruits of his not labor can be seen in Conan the Barbarian, because holy shit, is this guy ripped in this movie.
Well, okay, I'm going to have to take a little umbrage from you, because, yeah, pills and needles might have contributed to his physique, but you still have to go to the gym and work your damn hard. Yeah. You can't just take those pills and needles and expect to, you know, wake up
an Adonis.
Like, you know, Charles Atlas next morning. But, yeah, okay, steroids definitely figured in Schwarzenegger and also Hulk Hogan. Now, it's interesting you talked about rugged individualism, because this film starts off with a quote from Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of like a Nietzschean element that runs through this movie. Now, of course, the quote is, and it's translated, it's sort of
I don't even know if that's misattributed. Is it like actually what he said?
He said something to that effect, but the translation was not direct. It was sort of bolderized. It's obviously a very cliche quote, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. But yeah, I mean, there's a Nietzschean element to this movie about rugged individualism. Conan, he's not exactly an altruistic hero. In many ways, he's out for himself. Now, he sort of does meet up with people and he does help people. But that's a theme. See, because when we talk about Conan the Barbarian, or Conan the Adventurer, just Conan, period, we got to talk about the source. That being Robert E. Howard, who created the character of Conan in his series of novels. Actually, I'm no expert on Conan. From what I understand, Robert E. Howard, who also created other characters like Cull and Red Sonja and everything, I believe he only wrote one Conan novel, and the rest was sort of like poems and short stories, but then other writers took it and continued on with the legacy and the mythos and everything. When I was a kid, I would read the Marvel comics. You know, I would read a lot of Marvel comics with Conan the Barbarian. But there's things that are very important to the Conan myth, and that's the Sumerians. That's sort of the race that Conan comes from. Not mentioned much in the movie. And the other one being the Hyborian Age, which is sort of the time frame where Conan's adventures would take place. Now, again, the movie doesn't mention either. Or if it does, it's very much passing. This is the movie just basically gets right to it, in the sense that when we're beginning this movie, first of all, we gotta have voiceover. This is a sword and sandal movie, and we have some wonderful voiceover by a character who becomes prominent later on in the movie. He's the wizard. And I'm not going to repeat everything he says, but he says, there was a time when the oceans drank Atlantis. It was an age undreamed of. Conan, destined to wear the crown of Aquiloria? Is that what he said?
Oh my god, who knows?
Yeah. Upon a troubled brow, let me tell you the days of high adventure.
Oh my god.
And high adventure indeed. We are about to enter the days of high adventure. When the movie begins, we see a sword being forged. And we see a little bit of young Conan talking to his father, and his father's talking about Crum and Steel. His father tells him that Crum is your god, and he has a secret of the steel, and he has always carried with it a mystery. This you can trust. And he's referring to Steel. And we don't get a lot of time spent on watching Conan have this idyllic childhood, because within the first 10 minutes, his village is being attacked and burnt to the ground, and his family killed. So there's not a lot of preamble in terms of young Conan maybe practicing with the steel, or young Conan going off and maybe trying to woo a young lady. It's none of that. It's just,
Well, weird that you mentioned, this Howard author and the pulp origins in the 1930s, but I guess you can go back thousands of years for this whole tale is really like, we can get into the monomyths, but a guy who avenges his father's death, you got a sword. This is Homeric in its origins. Mm. It's like King Arthur stuff. This is like Lancelot's father was killed.
Luke Skywalker's father was killed.
Yeah, a little twist on it. Yeah.
In this movie, when you have James Earl Jones near the end saying, "You are my son, Conan. You are my son." I mean, I can't help but think, Luke, your father.
Yeah. That was pretty wild. Yeah. Not to mention his Planet of the Apes wig.
I was thinking it was kind of like circa early 2000 like hipster bang.
Oh yeah, you know, I was like, gonna say girl, 1976 Cher.
Well, no, but
she was married
too,
to Greg Oldman.
That too, but yeah, in the early aughts, as they call it, all the hipsters would have those like very symmetrical bangs.
Yeah. So
James Earl Jones was sporting quite the do in this one, but a great actor nonetheless.
Oh, for sure.
He looked ridiculous, but he was he acquitted himself phenomenally.
Oh yeah, and so this cavalry comes to town and just massacres. Conan's whole family and the entire village,
everybody.
Which was really cool.
Conan has to witness his father being eaten by dogs.
Mm.
So they massacre everybody except for the kids. And then Conan is taken to a undisclosed location. I don't know what. Parts unknown.
Yeah.
He's taken to parts unknown to continue with
the wrestling motif. Yeah.
And he's forced to toil on this mill sort of thing, this wheel, where he just pushes it, and it goes round and round and round. What was the purpose of that carousel of lumber?
Mill grinding. You have to make your mill sometimes. Yeah, unless it's some glorified metaphor for Fortuna's wheel, and it was like some fate, and that was his fate to go in circles. I don't know.
Well,
am I reading too much into it?
Maybe we
can account for his build.
Because
it looks like a real workout.
Talking about how this movie doesn't waste any time, we see Conan, young
flash
Conan,
forward,
working, and then flash forward, he morphs into older Conan,
and
he is now Ani, he is now big, he is strong, he has muscles upon muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, because I'm thinking to myself, if you're going to take kids and you're going to exploit them for some sort of slave labor, why would you do so in some sort of mechanism that would guarantee that they would become big, strong, and formidable, and ultimately some vengeance upon you?
I was going to say, you could fire you back a question: why they allow prisoners to just do nothing other than like read and work out? Because presumably, when they get out of there, they're jacked to the tits, and when they get out, they're stronger and angrier than before. Who knows? But that's a good point. I guess I don't know. A good slave is a strong slave.
Mm-hmm.
So Conan is conscripted to pit fighting, so gladiatorial combat, and that sort of speaks to this weird multi-historical reference points that the movie draws from. There's some warriors that look like Mongols. There's gladiatorial combat, like Roman times. Vandals, there's Goths. It seems like they took 1,000 years of human history.
I didn't see anybody dancing to Bela Lugosi. Dressed in black or moping around.
There's like 1,000 years of history was thrown in this movie, and it seems like every mythology was dumped into it as well. So like a kind of kitchen sink of history and mythology.
Yeah.
So it's kind of disorienting in a way.
And speaking of music, the main bad guy in this movie, the main heavy, played by James Earl Jones, is Thulsa Doom.
Oh, talk about, yeah.
Great name.
Great name, yeah.
Great name. And he's got two henchmen. And to me, they look like if you would take all three members of Spinal Tap, Stephen St. Hubbins, Nigel Tufnel, and Derek Small, put them in a blender and jacked up with roids, those would be the henchmen.
Yeah, I was going to say roadies from circa 1975 Led Zeppelin tour. Oh my God, the handlebars and the mullets, like galore.
Mm. Well, as I said earlier, as the narrator said earlier, this is a time of high adventure, and for Conan, the adventure is he's taken, he's thrown into the pits, he has to fight for his life, he fights well, he beats people with their bare hands, he doesn't utter a word for at least 20 minutes in the movie, then he's taken east to learn from the war masters, and he's being treated like a celebrity. At one point, they put him in sort of like a cage, not to keep him confined, but to bring in a young, nubile woman for him to make love to.
Yeah, sort of a eugenics experiment to create. Like, yeah.
And nothing really comes of that, but it was kind of funny because
they're all watching him. Yeah, yeah. He had no performance anxiety.
No, not at all. So Conan is the man. I mean, you know, thinking back, Your Hunter of the Future, that theme song, Your is the man. Yeah. Conan is the man. And ultimately, and this is the big mistake, is that they set Conan free. They set Conan free to wander the
desert, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds biblical, yeah, but yeah, and to ultimately be able to track down the perpetrators of the massacre that who claimed the life of his pops in this village.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, at first, I don't think he cares. He's happy with this lifestyle of, you know, being a celebrity in the pit fighting arena and to crush his enemies, see them driven before him, and hear the lamentation of their women. But Conan is nothing if not a ladies' man. And he comes across this very seductive temptress, and she lures him into her tent to keep warm by her fire, and she turns out to be some sort of witch or some sort of demon.
Yeah, some sort of succubus, siren type.
But she mentions a prophecy where Conan has to go to the land of Zamora, and that's going to set his adventures afoot. And then he starts to flashback and think about these two snakes coming together as one and their heads, you know, two heads meeting each other. And then he starts to think about Thulsa Doom. But what I found hilarious too is that as they're making sweet, sweet love, she turns feral and Conan just picks her up and tosses her into the fire.
Yeah.
Like as if he was just a piece of Kindle. It was hilarious. So, on to the next stage of the adventure. He's off to Zamora. He meets a thief played by Sandal Bergman. Her name is Valeria. And they decide to, you know, join forces to wander together. And they end up meeting a king, King Osric. Osric the Usurper, to be precise. And he is played by Max von Sydow, the wonderful Max von Sydow.
Yeah, whose speech in Hannah and Her Sisters, a Woody Allen movie, about where he plays like a cantankerous artist. And he talks about how wrestling is for like complete idiots, and it just made, well, our mutual friend, me, Noel, it just made me laugh so hard as we're talking about wrestling. But yeah, like one of the great actors of his time, and completely unrecognizable here, and very, I don't even know, did they dub his voice? I don't know.
I don't think
he was terrific.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I mentioned
in the Bergman staple.
Of course, I mentioned way back when one of our episodes that I used to have a summer of, you know, where I pick a filmmaker and just go through all their entire filmography within that summer, and I had a summer of Bergman, where I was watching nothing but Ingmar Bergman films. It was one of the most depressing summers of my life. But I was watching incredible movies, and of course,
he became really good at chess. I don't know.
And of course, Max von Sydow was sort of like the De Niro to Bergman's Scorsese.
Yeah.
And he's just a phenomenal actor. He doesn't play a large part in this, but he does set Conan and Valeria on their way to ultimately bringing down Thulsa Doom, because Thulsa Doom has kidnapped Osric's daughter and has her brainwashed. He's got this like snake cult.
Yeah, and I guess it's becomes gradually revealed to Conan through, again, as you said, the flashback instigated by this love tryst with this witch that, I guess that's one of the things he remembers from the massacre. Someone had some sort of snake insignia or something. Again, it's the two-headed snake that's, again, tons of mythology. It's the symbol for medicine. It goes back. It's Asclepius. It's Ouroboros. It's two snakes combining into one. It's the symbol of unity and in fertility and infinity and all the good stuff.
Right. So he starts Garden of Eden.
Oh, yeah. Everything.
Yep. This is a symbol of wickedness.
Yeah. It's everything. This movie has everything in it. So he finally finds out that the source of, or the perpetrator of this massacre, runs the snake cult, and they're, whose acolytes dress in these ridiculous pajama-type outfits with these weird cloth white gowns. It's almost like a, I don't know, like a Reverend Jim Jones kind of strange death cult. And then they are compelled to infiltrate it and then try and exact revenge and try and finally meet up with Thulsa Doom or Tulsa Doom?
Yeah, I believe it's Thulsa.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. No. Okay, living on Tulsa time. Yeah, so that's essentially it.
Well, it's essentially it, except for that, you know, you're glossing over a couple things. Number one, Arnie has to fight a gigantic snake, and that was fucking awesome.
It was fantastic.
That was a great scene. All the more so because it was rendered practically, so it was phenomenal. The other thing is, you know, we see this so often in movies. It's such a cliche in action movies where somebody needs to go undercover and they have to steal the garb of someone else.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And there's no ID that's checked. It's like, oh, as soon as you're wearing the garb, you're clear.
And you see something like a horror movie.
You've never worked here ever before.
Yeah, yeah. For instance, the killer in a horror movie, I think this was in X-Ray, maybe even. Or,
yeah, where he adopts the garb of a security guard or a doctor,
what have you. And in this one, it's one of these priests that wear these diaphanous weird robes with pointed hats, almost like Grand Wizard-like.
Yeah.
And this priest sees Conan, and he's sort of lascivious towards him.
Very strange, yeah.
And Arnie says...
He's complimenting his chiseled physique and everything.
His body, and he's saying, let's go somewhere to have some more privacy. And Arnie, you know, knocks him good. And Steele says how he was... Because this was a very slender priest. And when Arnie puts on the outfit...
Fits like a glove, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
More, the diaphanous robe fits, you must have quit.
It fits like the glove. I was going to say, during the OJ trial, it fit as well as that. But yeah, indeed.
It was a strange bit of homoeroticism, but maybe not so strange, given like the, well, I mean, we've just rattled off a litany of analogs to Greek myths, whether you're like, you're avenging the death, you're fighting this creature like Jason the Argonauts. There's a scene where he's crucified and a bird comes to peck out his eyes, which is like Prometheus and fire. Yeah. Like, oh my God, every single myth is shoved in here. And it just
so this is not the monomyth, this is the multi-myth. Yeah.
It really is. It makes you wonder, like, cause we both saw this as kids, and we're completely oblivious, and we're just sort of wowed by the broadswords and the leather and the fights and the cavalry and the villains.
Camel riding too.
It's just amazing how much is going on.
Ultimately, this is going to come down to a mano between Thulsa Doom and Conan. That's his destiny.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, you know, we're not going to spoil it. We're not going to say what happens at the end. But it is. As I said at the beginning, I mean, it was a time of high adventure, and this is a film of high adventure. So at this point, I think we should just go ahead and segue into what we learn.
Well, a la Game of Thrones, there's a line here where they are referring to him, and he says, "From the north will come a man of great strength," because Game of Thrones interminably references the north. Mm-hmm. North, north, north. And the winter is coming in the north, north, north.
Also, if you're watching Game of Thrones right now, winter is upon us.
And this movie is replete with references to how bad things smell. So as Conan becomes a cultural tourist under the wing of fellow thief Subotai, which sounds like a Thai restaurant down the street from you. And then everywhere they go is like, oh, here's this great village, and he says, oh, this place smells, and then he's making fun of like Subotai's gods. Your four wind gods are not the same as my god, etc., etc. So there's a kind of cultural chauvinism almost in a way that Conan operates through the world. And I don't know if anyone else picked up on this, but it's very bizarre. Like, his culture is the best, and then he gets taken to far-flung locales, and he's like dismissive of them, even though he's from an Iron Age culture that has nothing too other than pulleys and like giant circular millstones.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, when it comes to Nietzsche and theology, what was Nietzsche's theological
underpinnings. Yeah. I guess it's sort of an every man for himself, Übermensch ethos, where famously saying God is dead,
exactly.
Yeah, and every man is for himself is their own God.
And near the end of the movie, when Arnie is about, I keep saying Arnie, Conan. Near the end of the movie, when Arnie is about to face his destiny, come one-on-one against Thulsa Doom, he prays one last time to Crumb, to his god, and he says,
"Who's,
you know,
Harry Crumb,
Robert Crumb, Harry Crumb, no, anyway, and Crummy God, whatever, Crumb." Basically, what he says is, "Help me through this battle, guide my sword. But if you're not going to help me, then to hell with you."
Mm.
And that was interesting when it comes to theology, because he might say, you know, my god is better than your god, but near the end of the movie, he basically dismisses his god and tells him to go to hell, and still wins the battle. So another bit of Nietzschean God is dead, it's a bit of underpinning into this.
And earlier I think there was a reference to Valhalla too, so a Norse god. So I think they wanted to appease every possible group. And then there's Egyptian references in the underworld to Seth, who is the brother of Osiris and the god of the underworld. And like, my god, again, like if we're missing anyone, We apologize. I think every single ancient culture is broadly represented in this film.
Yeah, except for the Moops.
Yes.
A little Seinfeld reference.
Yeah. And also the acolytes sort of resembled Hare Krishnas in a way as well, like handing out flowers at the airport. I don't know, you don't really see much of Hare Krishnas anymore.
Yeah, no, it's true. In the 80s, they were using a lot of Hare Krishnas. Yeah, Hare Krishna, 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 Krishna. And yeah, that was, I guess maybe after 9/11, they just said, I don't know, with increased security of the airports, they
Put
the Krishnas out of there. I don't know. But you're right. That's, whatever happened to the Hare Krishnas?
I don't know.
We should start a new podcast. Instead, whatever happened to Richard Simmons or whatever, you know, which is blowing up, you know, whatever happened to the Hare Krishnas, you know?
Star rating.
Wait, yeah, what about what I learned?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I'm gonna get a little bit more serious and talk about the pedigree of this movie. There's a very interesting pedigree, a pedigree that you might not even expect. I mean, for one thing, this movie was directed by a man who was probably more known as a writer than a director, that being John Milius. He wrote Apocalypse Now. He also wrote Dirty Harry, Magnaforce sequel. But he directed this one, and he's not a very prolific director. Probably the other credit that he's most famous for is the original Red Dawn. But this movie also had a co-writer, and that being Oliver Stone. The famous Oliver Stone from Platoon and JFK and all these prestige movies. Look, the thing about Oliver Stone co-wrote Scarface, Brian De Palma's Scarface, yep. And he co-wrote this one.
So it's interesting you mentioned that he has he adapted Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness for Apocalypse Now, and clearly he infused this film with a lot of high-minded stuff. So it's interesting, as you generally just think of these movies as maybe just summer junk, but there's a lot going on, and depending on one's affinity for Oliver Stone, he likes to inject a lot into his films as well. So between the two of them, they obviously, a lot of thought went into the production.
Yeah, another thing that was amazing in this movie, it had a really majestic, powerful score. And the composer is somebody who's not a household name, Basil Poledouris, but he also scored RoboCop, and that really gave the movie a real sense of grandeur. I mean, this is a movie, sort of sandal movie, but they filmed it in Spain. There wasn't that much in the way of, like, when I say eye candy, there's a lot of eye candy in terms of, like, Ani, and there was also a lot of, wanton nudity thrown about, but there wasn't a lot of eye candy in terms of the architecture. But the music really put you into its time and place, so there was that. However, I'm going to say that, and maybe I have to go back and revisit, but looking back in sort of the halcyon haze of nostalgia, maybe rose-colored glasses, I kind of prefer the sequel to this movie, that being 1984's Conan the Destroyer. This movie was pretty damn serious. It was brutal. It was bloody. Sometimes it was even a little bit slow, but this was an adult movie. And as they did with many a property in the 80s, as they would start making sequels, they would get a bit watered down, bit more kid-friendly, and then kind of goofier, and the same thing happened with Conan. When they made Conan the Destroyer, the edict from the studio was, okay, let's get the kids in the cinema. So instead of making an R-rated film, try to make a PG film. And here we have Conan traipsing around with the likes of Will Chamberlain, Grace Jones, etc. And I just remember that being so fucking goofy, but so hilarious at the same time. Interesting enough, Arnie was contracted to play Conan two more times after Destroyer, but that was stymied for a couple of reasons. Number one, he did not like the kid-friendly direction of Conan the Destroyer. And number two, he made another movie. Very confusing, because I said earlier that Robert E. Howard created Red Sonja. And a year after Conan the Destroyer, there was a Red Sonja film that came out in the cinema, starring Bridget Nielsen. And Arnold was in it, basically playing Conan, but not Conan.
I remember,
He was playing a character by the name of Kalidor. And he only did that, because at this point he was pretty much washing his hands of the Conan character, he only did that as a favor to the producer Dino De Laurentiis, who produced Conan the Barbarian. Yeah. He pretty much owed his career to Dino for casting him as Conan. And he was only supposed to be on set for a week. It was supposed to be a glorified cameo. He was on set for 4 weeks. They pretty much turned him into a co-star. Arnold was pissed. None of that. but it's okay. He said, forget it. From now on, all my movies are going to be contemporary films or even futuristic films, because in between Conan the Destroyer, which did not do as well as Conan the Barbarian and Red Sonja, a little film called The Terminator came out, and Arnie was...
Shot to the stratosphere.
So, what did I learn? Not a whole heck of a lot, except for the fact that there was some really interesting pedigree to this movie. It's a lot more substantive than its reputation might
indicate. Yeah.
Certainly way more substantive than Conan the Story, but I kind of think I do prefer the goofiness of that one a bit more. I will have to revisit it and see how it is now that I've watched Conan, because it's been a long time since I've seen Conan, the Barbarian. So, star rating.
3.25, I'm going to say. I think 15 to 20 minutes over long, a little bit too purple, and lots of just endless speeches about the lamentation, as you said, of the women, and he's bred to the finest stock, and all this mumbo-jumbo about the secret of steel and the sword. Okay, enough with the sword. We get it. So a little bit overlong, but still kind of fun. There's a terrific battle with one of these vandal types wielding some sort of ginormous ball-peen hammer, and is trying to smack Conan, who's ducking, and he's smashing like these pillars, and the snake fight scene is really, you know, indelible and fantastic. So yeah, 3.25 for me.
There's also a really cool scene where Thulsa Doom becomes a snake and you see his face sort of slowly morph. And again, this is all the better because of practical effects. I don't know if you recall, I mean, it was in theaters for maybe a weekend. They made a Conan remake, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Where, I think 2012, yeah.
Yeah, Jason Momoa from Game of Thrones, who portraying Aquaman in Justice League,
Jesus.
Played Conan. And I had the misfortune of seeing that movie, and it was just a forgettable piece of shit. So, and just rife with terrible CG. So,
jeez.
And there has been talk over the years of Arnold reprising the role of Conan the Barbarian. Conan eventually becomes the king, so why not have Arnold as a wizened, aged king sitting on the throne and
some new upstart taking on the role of the son or whatever, yeah.
But definitely not Jason Momoa, because that was just terrible. But, I don't know. I mean, I'm up for more Conan adventures as long as they're done more like this and less like what was done in the remake.
And for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, and tune in every Friday for new episodes of the Really Awful Movies podcast. Send us your favorites, Sword and Sandal, High Adventure, Epic, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. We'll be sure to get to it, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.